one of the features of living in our region is that a lot of people moved here from somewhere else. So lots of origin points and cultures are represented by the people who live here now. The Oregon Folklife Network works to support the many cultures of Oregon through investments in traditional artists and the identifying of culture keepers. We'll get more information from Rochelle Ricky Saltzman. Ricky is folklore specialist with the Oregon Folklife Network. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Now, you are the former executive director, but stepped back from that job. Is that right?
Yeah. It was, you know, I'm kind of nearing retirement, and I really wanted to get back to being a folklorist and not doing just administrative stuff. So it's quite delightful to get to talk to real people and not just administrative people and interview them, which is how I started in this field. I love to hear people's stories, so it's been a real gift to be able to do that.
So is the Folklife Network very much about that, collecting the stories? I mean, just collecting bits of culture from people?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, yeah, we definitely are interested in the stories, but it's really about talking to regular people about their cultural traditions. This is the kind of stuff that people tend to take for granted, but it's who they are and helps to identify them to themselves and to others in their community. So, you know, I've interviewed teachers about teacher folklore, which is about colleagues or students, or maybe what their principal's been up to. You know, urban legends, everybody's pretty familiar with that. Used to be about the, you know, so-called quote-unquote Kentucky Fried Rat, but there were, oh, a few years ago in 2016, there were all the clown stories were invading Oregon, and my daughter.
I was going to say alligators in the sewers, but we have the clowns down there instead.
Yeah, we got clowns here, right? Yeah. I mean, I used to work in the state of Florida years ago, and yes, alligators, not in the sewers, but on land. They're there. But yeah, so we look at that. We look at different craft traditions, different music traditions, and really from people who have, you know, been here the longest, you know, our First Nations in Oregon, to the most recent refugees and immigrants. You know, we're having some Afghani folks coming in, probably to the Portland area. I don't know much more about it than that. You know, but we have African-American communities who've been here for well over a century, Koreans, Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, other Asian communities, folks from the Middle East. You know, so we kind of run the gamut. And it's really about, you know, listening to people talk about what's important for them and what they treasure and what they want to pass on to their children.
That was a really interesting thing you said at the outset, though, that culture is something that people who live in it take for granted, but it's who they are. In other words, not that culture is invisible to them necessarily, but it's so much a part of their daily life that it's something that actually stands out to people who are not in that culture, I would think.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And so usually, if I have to say, if somebody calls me and says, hey, I'm a folk artist, that person may not be what a folklorist considers a folk artist. You know, I'm interested in, you know, people who are quilters, people who are fly tiers, sheep shearers. I've actually got several sheep shearers kind of lined up to talk to over the next few weeks. One fellow on the South Coast who makes mandolin says, I'm not an artist. I'm not applying for this. It's like, yeah, actually, you are an artist. You know, he makes beautiful mandolins. And, yeah, so often it's, you know, it's people who do what they do because they love it. They can't not do it. And I'll often kind of end an interview, you know, after I've talked to somebody for an hour or so and say, so, you know, why is it you do this? It's clearly not for the money. I mean, I don't think there's a farmer or rancher around who would say they do it for the money. you know, or a rawhide braider or somebody like that. You know, or my Native American friends and colleagues at the different tribes. You know, it's a cultural imperative. They do what they do because it's who they are. You know, whether it's food gathering or basket making, or, you know, different rituals that are necessary for the beginning and for the end of life and for everything in between.
Ricky Saltzman is giving us an overview of the Oregon Folklife Network, where she is a folklore specialist. It is based at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History at the University of Oregon, and you can join our conversation on the exchange about the work of OFN at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So it's interesting. Once I was reading in the materials at the website for OFN that there's a distinction between folk art and folk-inspired art. And I think you gave us a taste of it already, that people will tell tell you that they are folk artists, and yet people who are doing folk art will sometimes insist that they are not.
Right. It's an interesting irony. Yeah, I think, you know, there's folks who've, well, I'll give you a couple examples that one of my friends told me years ago, that just because a dog has her puppies in the oven doesn't make them biscuits, which I think works. And most people get that, and they laugh about it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, another example might be that, you know, my background is Eastern European Jewish. I come from the Mid-Atlantic region, and while I did grow up with a musician, a music teacher for mother, and a millwright for a dad, if I were to, by some miracle, be actually a gifted Irish, you know, player of Irish fiddle tunes, that wouldn't make me Irish, you know. Mm-hmm. That would make me a good fiddler, I would hope, and maybe people might respect that, but it doesn't make me Irish. I'm not part of that culture. I'm definitely interested in it. And in the people who come from it, whether they're, you know, from Ireland or, you know, third, fourth, fifth generation Irish in this country. But, you know, we're looking for the people who grew up with it, who learned it in their occupations, learned it perhaps, you know, in a different group. You know, so whether it's your religion or your ethnic heritage of whatever sort that might be, it could be geographical. I mean, you know, rawhide braiders. I mean, I am not likely to become a rawhide braider. For one thing, I didn't start it as a young person. Two, I don't personally have access to the materials, but that doesn't keep me from admiring it and learning about it and, you know, kind of getting into the intricacies of it.
Okay, we've heard rawhide braider several times now. Is this one of your more recent interviews?
You know what? They're kind of all over, you know, a lot of Oregon, and you know, if people are ranchers or farmers, it's part of their lifestyle. And I have to admit, I'm kind of fascinated with it because it's extremely intricate work that mostly men do.
Mm-hmm.
Some women do it, but it is mostly men, and it would be sort of akin to, you know, perhaps embroidery or crochet or knitting or even quilting. You know, the really more intricate stuff that, you know, we tend to associate with women, but it isn't always women. There's men quilters too, and there's women rawhide braiders, saddle makers. I mean, I guess, you know, for me, you know, I've lived in different parts of the country. I've learned about different folklore all around the country. And so for me, it's always like, oh, what's here? What don't I know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fun part. You know, I mean, if I can learn something and I get to ask questions of somebody who's been doing it forever and whose community acknowledges, and people say, yeah, talk to this person. This person knows everything. You know, then that's what I'm going to do.
So you find the key people at the Oregon Folklife Network, and then how do you invest in them? What are the resources of the OFN for making grants and things like that?
We don't have grants per se. We do have a few programs. So one is, so the first stage usually is one of us or an independent contractor folklorist going out, identifying, documenting, interviewing the traditional artists. They do what's called metadata, you know, write it all up. These days we're on Zoom because everybody is mm-hmm. dealing with the pandemic still. And it starts with writing a short biography for the person, a cultural biography, and then checking it back with them. And then they go on our Culture Keepers roster, if they want to be, and say, you wanted to interview a bunch of quilters on your show next week, and you kind of looked on our roster and searched on quilt or quilters, and you would come up with a group of people, and you would go, oh, I can read their bios. I can find out some more about them. You know, so they could be at a museum demonstrating. They could go into a school and do a workshop or, you know, whatever. Maybe it's the old-time fiddlers. And then we also have two other programs. One is our Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program, where master artists, people who are acknowledged, again, by their community as being really good as what they do. It comes out of the old, you know, union and guild system. The NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, started it. It was one of the really first programs that many states first adopted, because it's a great one for doing in-depth field work and working with individuals to document what they do. And they come in with somebody from the same culture group who's sort of at, you know, journeyman level. You know, they know what they're doing, they're pretty good at it, but they really need some polish to learn how to get to that next level. And so they apply as a team, and a group of reviewers, usually, you know, one other traditional artist who's been a part of the program, maybe a folklorist or two, usually, you know, some cultural experts in a particular field, will be on the review panel, and they select the next group, and they spend the next 6 to 8 months doing what they're doing. They present with a group of lessons and, you know, kind of a, here's what we want to learn. You know, maybe we're going to learn to make a saddle or really learn the details of leather carving, or maybe we're going to be building a mandolin, you know, whatever it might be. And again, the idea is that by the end of it, they do a public presentation, and one of our staff would usually go out to interview them. And yeah, and so then they show up on our website as being part of that project. And then the third one is a program called Culture Fest, which is funded largely by the Oregon Cultural Trust, and that involves partnering with cultural organizations in an area where we've recently done a survey field work, and we've divided the state up into different areas. So Southern Oregon, the inland part, Josephine Jackson and Douglas County, and the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Tribe of Indians is in this current survey that I'm doing, which is where you picked it up. Mm-hmm. And we would be working with organizations within that group and partner with them to help them pick some traditional artists from their area who might be part of ongoing programming, or it might be something totally new, and they get some funding for that. That would mostly pay the artists, as well as some, you know, some funding for administrative expenses and publicity.
Ricky Saltzman, once again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, folklore specialist with the Oregon Folklife Network, and we're talking about the process of preserving culture in Oregon, all kinds of cultures from all kinds of places. If you'd like to join us, 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. So at this point, you're essentially looking to add to the list of culture keepers with a particular emphasis on Southern Oregon?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, actually a total emphasis on Southern Oregon, because that's what I'm focused on probably through next June or July.
Mm-hmm. And so are there, Ricky, some bits of culture, some kinds of art that have, I mean, I have to presume there are some that have already been lost, but there are some that have been lost in recent memory simply because there weren't efforts like you're talking about here to get apprentices trained?
You know, I'm sure there have been. Nothing comes to mind at the moment. But usually, I mean, I think culture, you know, life changes. It ebbs and flows. And, you know, people preserve and pass on what they can. If it's important to them, then we're interested in it. I mean, it might be that, you know, food traditions are the one critical thing. You know, say somebody is from away and they come here and they may not be able to get the exact ingredients for what they're looking for, but they can find ones that are comparable, and then they produce, you know, an American version of whatever that is. You know, I think with musicians, we had a interesting case in Iowa where this lovely man, Dwight Lamb, who is of Danish heritage, and he's, I think, a fourth-generation immigrant, maybe third, and he played Danish fiddle tunes that weren't played in Denmark anymore, and some young people from there, just, you know, so quote-unquote discovered him, and they came to this country, and they studied with him, and then brought those back over. So often in, that's what gets lost in cultures that have been disrupted, you know, whether it's through war or immigration, sometimes disease, sometimes life. You know, people don't always have time to do everything. And I'd say that's one of the things where you might learn something as a kid or be familiar with it, and you may not have time to do it until you retire, but you kind of keep your hand in. You know, I think that's really common in a lot of groups. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're busy with a career, with working, with raising kids, you know, you're just kind of getting through the day and trying to make the money and all to survive. And while other people in your community, you know, the older women and the older men may be doing it, when you reach that point yourself, then it's time for you to do it if you're interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in fact, I was just talking with some friends at the Warm Springs Reservation, and some women who are, you know, my age or a little bit older are saying, oh my gosh, we're the elders. We have to make sure we pass this on to the kids. You know, so it's bits and pieces of that.
I only chuckle because I'm in the same age range myself. It's like, wow, what happened? We're the elders now.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right, because we don't feel like it, do we?
No. So what can you give a rough estimate of, like, how many of the kinds of things you preserve at OFN or assist in preserving are traditional Native American sorts of things versus things that came in here with Europeans or are coming in with new cultures? It's like a three-way split, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's, you know, the Native American cultures, which were horribly, horribly disrupted, as we all know. And now there's new curricula coming out. It's going to be taught in the schools. And I think all the tribes are involved in creating bits and pieces of it, if not most of it. So, yeah, I mean, you've got, you know, if you look at the immigration patterns of people who came to Oregon, you know, so you've got an upland south migration. You've got the so-called pioneers. That because you could, I'm forgetting the term, that if you claim a piece of land, you could homestead it. And then, you know, you get your allotment and you're there and your children and your children's children, and suddenly we're at about a fifth generation. But each of those groups is not just, you know, they are not coming from a vacuum. You know, they may come from an, you know, Anglo-Irish Scots culture in the background there. They may be Romanian. They might be, you know, Czech. They could be from different parts of Central and South America, you know. And people tend to settle in areas where other people from their same group, you know, you'll often find a whole town of people has its roots in a town somewhere else. You know,
oh,
and
sure.
You can see it in the place names of different places in Oregon. So I would say, you know, we have prioritized Native American cultural traditions and individuals and tribes to a large degree. I would say maybe 25% to 30%. I haven't worked the numbers, so I can't tell you that specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we felt it was important, and they felt it was important. And we if we're doing that kind of work, it's on their terms. It's their culture, not mine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what they say is okay to do. I mean, with any group or individual, I always check back and say, hey, this is going to be public. Are you comfortable with this? Mm-hmm. If you're not, we won't.
All right.
Promote it. We won't do anything.
All right. We will make sure that we're linked to we are already at the Oregon Folklife Network from our website at jeffexchange.org. This is the Oregon Folklife Network. Ricky Saltzman is folklore specialist. Thank you for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it,
sure.
Jeff.